Bonjour, bonjour, bonjour. Welcome to the SBS Cycling Podcast. I'm Christophe Mallet, I'm your host. And today I am with the wonderful and amazing Grace Brown. How are you, Grace?
I'm very well. Thanks, Christophe, once again.
Yeah. It's a funny time of the year here. We are approaching the Tour de France. We're less than 2 weeks away. We're like 10 days away from the start of the Tour. It feels a bit like we are in limbo. Yet again, there's a racing happening.
Yeah, well, I don't know. It feels a little bit quiet the past week, actually, for me. There's been a few races, but not like the big ones that really catch our attention. We're in anticipation.
Big time. Let's talk about Tour de Suisse. We knew it would be an interesting race. Joao Almeida won this race on the last day. What was your rating of that race? UAE again. I think they played a different game on this race.
Yeah. Well, I think it was really the time trial in the end that put Joao Almeida ahead of the rest. It was Kevin Vaakalan that was in the lead for majority of the race, wasn't it? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Kevin Vaakalan, and he had 35 seconds lead heading towards the final day. And a big question here in France was, can he do it? And he should not be shy, and that would be tough. And Vaakalan has done a great year. You know, he's finished podium here, and then he's having an amazing year for Arkea, a team that is a serious difficulty as well, financial difficulties.
Yeah, it's definitely, it would have been nice, I think, for the French to have their win, but once again, pipped at the line, taken from you at the last moment. But yeah, that final time trial by Joao Almeida was really impressive. And I think I read a quote from him where he said he thought he's, power meter wasn't working because his numbers were so high. So he's obviously on some very good form.
Yeah, and again, this team Arkea is in trouble because the sponsor, I think, has dropped off. I think they dropped off for next year. So they don't know what is going to happen. No one is knocking at the door. It's a story we've seen before, you know, especially for French teams. And riders have been left. Audrey Cordon-Rago, for example, was left out. There was a lot of stories that in the women peloton, that has happened before, and this could happen on the Arkea team. Seriously, there's a serious concern about it.
Yeah, I feel we hear this, you know, it's unfortunately a bit too common that the sponsorship that teams have isn't, you know, they don't have like really long contracts with their sponsors. Sometimes it's only for a few years, and we see teams time and time again come into struggles, even some of the biggest teams we've seen fold due to not being able to re-sign their sponsorship. So, yeah, it's just one of those issues of the sport where there's not really a sustainable model.
Mm-hmm. And that's what One Cycling is trying to change. And whether we agree, we don't, there's some downfall. But it's one thing that the problem is highlighted here. It's a known problem.
Yeah, definitely. The fact that, you know, the only revenue that teams are getting is through sponsorship. That's, you know, they're organizing themselves and there's nothing through the actual racing. I mean, there's a lot of criticism, I think, about One Cycling just because of where the money is coming from. But we do need a new model, I think.
Yeah, that, I think that's the point. And we discussed it several times that this might not be the right model or not. I mean, I'm no one to judge if it's the right model or not. But at least it highlights an issue. It highlights a problem. And he put it at the forefront. And he's putting it kind of in the face of the ASO and the UCI of this world.
Yeah, definitely. I think, well, like it's forcing the UCI and the ASO to maybe look a little bit at what they're doing and realize some of the flaws of the current system, that it's just not, like, it's not going to work in the long term, I don't think. It's just sort of holding together with sticky tape.
Let's go back to Joao Almeida. What does this win mean for him? We know also in the spirit of the team, and I'm talking more about who is the second man in that UAE team, and we saw this whole Del Toro, and I'll say it, debacle at the Giro, with no other words. What does that mean for someone like Joao Almeida as his positioning in the hierarchy of the UAE Emirates team? Or maybe nothing. Maybe we draw anything out of it.
Yeah, it's really hard to say. I think like each race that we see these secondary riders do for UAE, we think, oh, well, is this, does this mean something? Like, are they the next one in line after Tade? But it's very hard, I think, to pull apart. We've got, yeah, João Almeida, we've got Del Toro now, and also Ayuso.
Yeah.
And maybe you could even say Adam Yates, or I don't know if he's just considered now a super climbing domestique.
Well, Adam Yates, do you think that actually, so interesting story to interrupt, but do you think Adam Yates has got a chip on his shoulder now, like brother's got now two Grand Tours? He wants at least one. He wants one to put over the fireplace, at least.
Yeah, I don't know. I think Adam has had some pretty significant wins that he can be proud of as well. But yeah, maybe he's missing the Grand Tours. I don't know. He might have to sort of crack into the Yates family WhatsApp chat and see what's going down.
Imagine the banter sitting around the Christmas tree.
It's the favorite child.
Yeah, exactly. And it's funny because Simon always struck to me as being the quiet one compared to Adam. But then the quiet people achieve amazing things.
Yeah, I think they, like, neither of them are huge personalities. They're both a little bit reserved. And like when I was on Green Edge and they were both on Green Edge, to be honest, I couldn't tell them apart. So it was very useful once they went to different teams.
Yeah, we were sort of told off at some point with Mark, because we kept on making that joke about the switcheroo. Like the only thing they had to do is switch colors of socks, and then you would be completely confused. You'd be confused on which one is which. But anyway, let's talk about Jack Ward. Now I want to have a chat with you about Jack Ward. He's won the Pro Velo Super League. He's now signed a very interesting contract with Little Trek. It's a multi-discipline as well contract. So when you're young, when you're coming from Australia, that proved that system could work, like the Pro Velo Super League. And all the effort that's been made, including by us, I mean, let's not be shy, SBS has been a super partner of the Pro Velo Super League. But there's a lot of people around the country that can have a good tap on the shoulder. And the first one is Jack Ward. What a success story it is so far.
Yeah, I mean, I think, I don't know if there's been any like controversial commentary around the fact that, you know, he was basically given a contract with Jake Olula, but he's chosen now to go to Little Trek, which is completely within his right. Like the prize for winning the Pro Velo League is not a binding contract with no choice.
Yeah, it's an opportunity. It's an opportunity. It's there if they want it, basically.
Yeah. But I wonder if we're going to see this a bit with the riders that win Pro Velo League end up getting alternative offers anyway and never actually taking the Jake Olula contract. And is that a problem, or is that like just showing that the system's working?
I mean, it's a good question. Like, do you think management, and we know management at Jake had a bit of tumultuous time in the last few months also, but do you think some people are a bit gypped at Jake that someone like Ward escaped, or are they happy that they've been supporting the system and that's part of the game? Because they offered a contract, but like you said, it wasn't legally binding. You when you go into the two, you have to give them a girl. So are they going to look at the contracting a bit closer? Are they a bit jipped, or do you think you know them from inside out? Would they be supportive of something like this?
Well, I guess, you know, they would have been able to make a bigger offer as well if they really wanted to hold on to Jack. But yeah, I don't know. I guess it depends how happy they were to sign the rider that wins, whether they feel like it's a loss or not. But
that's a good point, because that's the other thing, is that it's also a gamble for a team like Jayco saying, yeah, we sign the person that wins, but they might not want that rider. He might not fit the roster. He might not fit the culture. It's not because you're Australian that you necessarily fit the culture, etc. So it's a double-edged sword for a team like Jayco.
Yeah, it could end badly. either way. Mm-hmm. So
yeah,
I guess, but it's good. Like, it's good marketing for them.
In terms of on the road, what else have we learned this week? There's been a couple of races. There's been racing in Copenhagen. I saw a comment, actually, I want to talk to you about it. Groenewegen. He's made a comment, I think that was on Cycling News, where he said there's much, much more at stake for him at this Tour de France that's just winning stages. He's eyeing the yellow jersey on day one. Of the tour,
right.
How important would that be for him to get that yellow jersey after the whole story that we know is what he's been through over the years? Also for Jayco, getting a yellow jersey on day one, and is he realistic? And is he not announcing this a bit too soon, or is he super confident that he can announce it right now?
Yeah, it's really interesting because I don't think. You know, we've had certain sprinters dominate in various tours, you know, like Pedersen, Milan, and Groenewegen has won a lot of like very specific sprint races. But we haven't seen Philipsen just win every race like, you know, was the case last year. So I think it's definitely something that can be a target for Groenewegen. And it's not, you know, it's not every Tour de France that you get a sprint stage on stage one. So it's a pretty good opportunity for a sprinter to be able to wear the yellow jersey because it's rare. I think, like, why not go for it? It's not completely unrealistic. Mm-hmm.
What about the fact that he's announcing it? The fact that he's saying it loudly, is it to be confident, to appear confident? Is it or is it just, you know, comment that was picked up probably by the press and then that's it? Like, it could also be amplified very quickly.
Yeah, that could be the case. But I think it depends on the psychology of the individual rider. You see some riders that really shy away from making any big claims about their goals, and then some, like, yeah, I can only think of examples in the women's peloton, like Anna van der Breggen, for instance, would always talk down any of her ambitions. Like, she's, you know, not trying for too much, and then she'll come and win everything.
I hated people like this at school. You know, you come out of the exams, they go, I failed everything. And they go, you know,
Top. I'm the same, because I always believed them. And then you'd be like patting their back and saying, it's okay,
Okay. You still got it. You're going to make it. And then they smash it.
And then they smash it. Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, let's talk about the women's peloton. What's happening right now in the women's peloton?
Yeah, well, I think the main racing over the past week was the new Copenhagen sprint in Denmark. And yeah, it was quite interesting because this is a new race on the calendar, but it was already World Tour. It's not usually how it happens. I think you have to do like 1 or 2 years as a continental level race or a point or a pro level race before you get elevated to World Tour. So I'm not quite sure how they got around that. And then from both the women's and the men's peloton, there were criticisms about the safety in the race and how dangerous it was without marking out the traffic islands and other hazards. So,
and on top of it, you add the new UCI handlebars as well, which also were criticized at the Copenhagen. And so it's a lot of safety concern there.
Yeah, I think the riders are just a bit annoyed, which is, in my mind, reasonable that the UCI are putting rules about handlebars when they're not setting standards in these races to have like proper marshalling and making sure that the race organization is up to scratch for safety, which is, you know, a bigger issue, I would say, than the width of a handlebar.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, we said 10 days away from the Tour de France, and in the second part of this podcast, we will talk about timing, and I want your opinion on timing, but we're sitting 10 days away from the Tour de France. Tadej Pogacar doesn't look like he can be beaten in any way, shape, or form. Vingegaard looks like the favorite second. And we can see now also that Remco Evenepoel might be aiming for the third place at the very best. This is where we're standing right now. Could we have the same podium? Is it how you see the podium shaping up? I know a lot can happen in the tour, but Have we learned anything more? Have we surprised? Have we come up with something else other than that storyline? And is it a bit boring to already think about this right now?
I really hope that something else will come up. It looks like the inevitable storyline, which is sort of disappointing. But I think, like, barring any misfortune for the three of them, that's what the podium is going to be. Yeah, but being the tour, of course, there'll be some drama somewhere, and potentially someone that we're not thinking about right now,
yeah,
might get in there.
This is why the expectation of the tour also is so big. Is that toy line going to be unveiling exactly correct or not? I mean, this is what the suspense is. No, pretty much.
Yeah, exactly. It was even when we're pretty sure what might happen, there is still a suspense because there's still a lot of things that can get in the way of that.
Yeah, and that's not even counting the weather or landslide or, you know, stuff like this that could happen has already happened at the Grand Tour. Okay, we take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk timing on racing. Don't go away. Welcome back to the second part of this SBA Cycling podcast. Grace, now I want to chat about timing with you. I had an interview with a couple of guys that are running a company called Time It, and they do the timing, and you'll hear in the interview on many races, including Tour Down Under, but also the Melbourne Marathon, for example. But you're someone that have been fighting all your life against the clock. These guys are in it. They make time happen, if you want. They make time a reality for cycling races. But you've been fighting all your life. Do you still have nightmare about fighting the time or the clock, or count in your head? Do you find yourself, you know, if I go to this point, I'm going to take 6 seconds and not five, or that sort of thing?
I think maybe before the Olympics, I was dreaming about chasing time, but thankfully I've let it all go, and now I sleep soundly and don't think that, unless I've got an alarm, and then that annoys me, and then you're like trying to warp time in a different way.
Yeah. Well, maybe this will bring back some nightmares for you, but let's listen to this interview with the team at Time It.
And now in the podcast, it's about time, that we talk about the time. We've got the guys from Time It with us. Maybe introduce yourself, Stuart, first, maybe.
I'm Stuart. I've been a timekeeper for close to 15 years and done many, many sports across Australia and the world.
Absolutely. And Hugo, we've had you in a French program on SBS before, but it's the first time on the actual podcast.
Yes, thanks for having us again. I'm the director at Time It Sports Timing, and we time events in Australia and worldwide, mainly in cycling, triathlon, running, and everything you can time, really.
So time is the essence, as the saying say. Stuart, how important is your job in any sort of time-bound sports? You know, maybe there's no sport. Can I think of a sport that doesn't have time? But if we talk here about cycling, for example, Tour Down Under, you've done many other races, time is key. Time is what people are fighting against. It's not necessarily just on the time trial as well.
Absolutely. So cycling is interesting because milliseconds count. So time is very important to us. And obviously, an event of that size, or any event really, you have to get it right.
What's the margin of error? Is there any margin of error?
No, you have to get it right. So for an instance, a finish line of the Tour Down Under, you might be within one pixel wide of someone becoming first or second. So that could be somewhere in the range of 300 milliseconds. So it's a very, very small margin.
You have to get it right. Yeah, talk to us about the technology behind, because it's not simply just a strip on the road, I guess. There must be much, much more that goes behind the scenes.
Yes, so in cycling, the official time comes from a photo finish camera, which just scans the finish line 5,000 times per second. And then we also have transponders on each bike to support with the photo finish scoring. So it helps us identify the participants quicker, and also to publish live results. Like anytime there's many laps, for example, we couldn't score everyone on the photo finish at every lap. So that's where the transponders are very useful to help us tell a story and show the gaps at every lap very quickly.
In the olden days, when the timing was maybe not done this way, you could just go ta-ta-ta, and then if you were in a group, you had the time of the group. Is that still the case? Because there's so much data that comes in at some point, and then after that you refine. When you have a big group of peloton, you don't make a difference between who's top of the peloton and back of the peloton.
We have to score everyone. And
so you still register everyone against the time.
It's not just the time that is important in cycling. It's also the place. Even when you have a big bunch, you need to know exactly the position, because it counts. Like if two riders are on the same time, then we have to add up their places. And we've seen that in the Pro Velo Super League. There's a stage, there's a round, I think it was the Sydney round, where Talia Appleton came second just on countback because they had the same time. And then we had to add all the places. And that's what determined who was the winner of the tour. So it's not just about getting the time right, but we also need the position of each and every rider.
But that's a real change, where in the past, people were finished in the group, they were just there in the group, and they could have been 27th or 69th. It would be the same. But in nowadays, it's not the same.
Yes. Now we have much more precise technology at our hands to do all that.
Do you get complaints from cyclists, from team directors, the sportive directors, anybody else that they... How do you... And behind my question is, how do you induce the trust in the technology to all the people that are fighting against it?
It's an interesting one. I think people aren't sure of exactly the result at the time because they may have a perception of what they saw. So when we're able to provide information based on the technology, whether it's photo finish, whether it's transponders, and a collection of the both, we can actually go to them and say, hey, this is the actual result. And then they're appreciative of us telling them what the result was, because again, it could be what they've seen or what they've heard in that way.
The technology, we said this is where we are now, but are you excited with what's ahead of us? With everybody's talking about AI, everybody's talking about the jumps in all this. Are you excited with, or is the sport, because it's a more traditional sort of area, cycling, is it going to take time to catch on with the actual day-to-day life technology?
I think AI and certainly technology moving forward will have its place in cycling and timekeeping moving forward. I don't know exactly where that will be. In terms of timekeeping and scoring, there's obviously a high accuracy and precision that you need to have to be able to produce a result. I think that AI will technology will have a small place and also help us to gather more information. But in terms of the actual finish score, that will be determined by technology that's, you know, proven.
D'accord. Okay. Well, d'accord. That's me. Reverting back. But and Hugo, how do we come in Australia and start a timing company? That's a bit of an odd one, or is it?
Yes. I started organizing events as a teenager in France, and then met a sports timer. Who introduced me to Resch Result, that's a provider of timing technology in Germany. And I was there for a few years supporting customers. And then I decided to become a timer myself and got the opportunity to come here to Australia for 6 months, working with Aaron Clark at Event Timing and timing the Tour Down Under and other exciting events. And I liked it so much that I met my wife here, and then we moved here in 2021 and founded a business. And now we support events ourselves with our own business, doing events like the Dirty Warnie and Rattle Gravel, so gravel racing. And now we've been appointed this year to time the first season of the Pro Velo Super League, mm-hmm. And we really love it here.
I was going to say the Pro Velo Super League, you lived it at the core. We supported it from the broadcast point of view and the sponsorship point of view for the women's side. But how was it at the core? Because you're the essence. You basically were what the people were fighting with.
To us, it was really exciting being a part of it, because it gave us the opportunity, all of a sudden, to go do all those races that are very like a part of cycling history in Australia, like Tour of Tasmania and Melbourne to Warrnambool and Grafton to Inverell. They're really staples on the Australian calendar, and having the opportunity to be a part of this was really great. And also seeing like young riders getting an opportunity at maybe joining a team in Europe, and yeah, this pathway to the very elite, that was really great to witness.
It's absolutely being at the core of Australian cycling, absolutely. Stuart, if we just go back on the technology, is there anything that makes you salivating for the times ahead? We talked about AI, but there must be something in your area that is the fact that now maybe we go three times after the comma, maybe if we go four, is there more precision? Is more precision better, or are we reached a point where precision is enough at the minute?
Look, I think you can always increase the precision. You can also increase the accuracy. You can also increase just the reliability of anything in technology. Technology is great. There are sometimes that technology doesn't work. That's why you have systems in place to make sure that you don't just have one system. You have backups and procedures. Technology is an interesting space. I think that in future, there will be technology that we don't even know at this point. AI, using of mobile phones potentially for assisting in some sort of tracking of participants, that type of thing. I think there's space in that area, but technology is something where you just don't know what's happening in the future.
Is it a need for the teams, do you think, to just not look at the finish point, but also to have live tracking, to have there's a lot of live trackers when you go on a stage of the tour. I was lucky last year to be with Mark Renshaw sitting in a car with him, and I could not believe the amount of technology he had down to the actual particular corner, and he knew the times everywhere and all this. Is it something that there's a demand for the team, the demands from the rider? Demands for
absolutely technology and that type of thing that you're talking about, which is a tracking which can be predictive or actual based on GPS, will absolutely help teams, especially in cycling, but it also helps tell a story. There are cases where we potentially wouldn't use it for an official score because it's not accurate enough for us. However, it does tell a story. It does help the broadcast teams display information on the screen, whether it's, you know, average speed, whether it's where people are within the race. So it gives us the opportunity to tell more of a story and ultimately the viewer.
Okay. And maybe one last word, Hugo. What's the future like for you? Is there anything that makes you salivating when you hear what we just said here?
Yeah,
is it something you want to be part of, I guess?
Yeah, if we look at GPS tracking at the moment, we usually have like 10 trackers just following the race vehicles. But we're seeing at the moment, for example, on races in Switzerland, they've made it that every rider has a tracker, and you see it in the biggest races. And I think what's exciting is as technology develops and gets maybe the trackers get smaller and more affordable, then we'll see it like at more and more races that we can actually track all the riders and provide more information and tell the story a bit better and more in a more visual way for viewers. And
but also, and I jump on this as well, late last year there was an accident in Switzerland where the rider simply disappeared, and in the end she passed away in a big crash, but the team didn't know where she was. They lost track of her somewhere, and the tracker played a point to locating her. So that's also there's a safety level on this.
Yes, as timers, we're not just here to produce a result. There's we also provide like dashboards for the organizer to know exactly like how many participants are still on course and pinpoint like who are the outstanding riders, and if the sweep has gone past a point but some riders haven't, then we can identify them quickly and look for those riders and then contact the team managers or the riders themselves to make sure they're accounted for.
So the point here, and I'll conclude on this, is do you think the tracker will move to the rider's body more than just the bike? Because if you switch a bike, then you might not have the tracker with you. So is there a move where the tracker will be more of a wearable part of your clothing, your equipment, more than just your bike?
It would make sense to slip it in a pocket rather than on the bike, because as you say, in cycling, there's a lot of crashes and you end up with riders on the spare bike quite often.
Yeah, that would make sense. Anyway, that's all. Thank you for coming on the SBS Cycling Podcast. It's always good to talk about the technology from a different kind of angle. Thank you.
Thank you.
So that was Time It and this whole story about timing. Sorry if I brought back bad memories for you, Grace, on thinking about time. Once again, is it something in your day-to-day life that you've been able to let go easily and you're more comfortable with now being late? Or do you always have to beat the clock? And I just emphasize this, in France, we always have a 10% buffer. We sort of never on time. Being on time is within a bracket of 10%.
I think I'm a time optimizer. So I'm not necessarily always on time. And sometimes I think that I can do more with my time than I actually can. I'm often a little bit late because I've pushed. I don't want to get somewhere early and wait because it's a waste of time. I think my approach when I was racing in a time trial was a little bit more exact.
Yeah. And just to conclude on this podcast, but when you were a time trialist, was it part of your concentration to also factor in the timing side of the race? Because that's all you do in a way. That's all you fight for in a time trial. That's your first frenemy, I guess.
Yeah, it's interesting. I wasn't so concerned about like the actual time passing, but definitely speed. So I was more focused on speed and making sure that my speed was as high as possible. And by that, I was reducing time.
Okay. If that makes sense. The result was you're reducing time, but your concentration was not necessarily on the time. It was on the actual process, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
And folks, that's how you become an Olympic champion. You know, if listening to this podcast. Thank you, Grace. It was amazing to have you all year, actually, so far on our podcast. And you'll be popping in and out of our Tour de France coverage as well. And of course, we'll hear a lot more about you and with you on SBS. Thank you, Grace.
Thanks, Christophe. Until next time.